Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, that was our technical difficulty for the night. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Vertical, A Taste of Ink. I'm your host, Celeste Duckworth, and I'm the publisher of Vertical Magazine. And today our guest is author Helen Downing, whose book, Awaken Hell, is on the plate for discussion today. The music you just heard was a beat called God, Dear God by Marcus Boyd, who is a part of one of our entertainment first persons that we like to promote, and we hope to hear Marcus and mainstream music soon. Today's program is sponsored by Paulette Bowe, the owner of Paulette's Refurbished Laptops. You can find her on Facebook at Paulette's Refurbished Laptops. So now I'm getting ready to open the line for our guest, Helen Downing, and we're going to get started. Hi, Helen. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fantastic, and really, I'm excited about sharing your book. I was reading it this week, and it's just, there were just parts of that book that was just hilarious, okay?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's a great read, and so everyone out there, put your foot up, feet up, you know, grab you some coffee or whatever your special drink, and we're going to talk with Helen Downing. So, Helen, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and, you know, let's get started.
Okay. Well, I am from Delaware. I was born and raised here. My father is actually a Methodist minister, which for all of you out there who have already read the book, you might be able to surmise that my father was a little disconcerted when it first came out because, you know, all he saw was the beginning, and he saw, you know, a lot of the language and stuff in the beginning. And so my father was my very first critic, and once he got through the book and he got to the end and he read the whole book, you know, he looked at me and said, okay, I no longer feel the need to wash your mouth out with soap. So that is still my very, very favorite review. other than that, I'm by day, I am a media account executive. I sell radio. And by night, I'm a writer.
Okay.
That's great. I'm the mother of the two most beautiful children ever born. That's
That's always great. I mean, how old are your children?
My daughter is 21, and my son is about to turn 11.
Oh, so you still have one that's at that great adolescent stage. I remember my kids are spaced that way as well, and I remember going through adolescence with my daughter. And one day, and she had just moved out. She had just turned 20-something and moved out. And my son, we were at the grocery store, and my son says to me, he goes, Mom, he goes, I'm never going to go through adolescence like my sister did. And I said, please don't lie to me.
Yeah, please don't lie to me. Boys are easier than girls, though, because I was ready to kill her. When she was 15, I thought she's never going to make it to 16. She will never see the behind the wheel of a car because she's not going to live that long. But, we made it through.
Yeah, that is so true. That's, you know, and it's interesting because I didn't know too many women who were, you know, had that same age difference with children. So I know the challenge, definitely, and especially as you working and being a writer, that it is a challenge.
It is, but it's a good challenge to have. It really is. And I like to tell people that, you know, I'm the mother of two only children because they are spread out so far apart. But so, you know, that they both have the kind of only child experience, but they also have a sibling.
Yes.
And I think when they get older, I'm hoping anyway, when they get older, they'll, you know, the age difference will start to constrict a little, and they'll be able to be good friends and you know, get through the later part of their lives, you know, with the relationship that you have with siblings, and yet they'll both have had, at a different point in their lives, they'll both have had 100% of my attention, so...
Well, they will. I tell you, I was a young mom, and so I have two. My daughters are about 10 years apart, and then my son, actually, you know, we adopted him. He's almost that same age difference. But the great thing is that they are all great friends. You know, the oldest tends to mama, and the youngest tends to mama my son, but. It's great to know that even though they went through all the things they did, that they really are great friends with each other. They have their own little world. They do. I want to read a little excerpt from your book before my next question. This is the part that I put this on the invite. Waking up in hell is the worst part of my day. During sleep, you can kind of forget where you are, dream about happy places, happier times. Other than the heat, the oppressive heat that is always here, because what else would hell be if not hot? I just love the first statement. What inspired you to write Awake in Hell?
Well, you know, I would love to say that I, you know, crafted this story through, you know, a lot of ponderance and thought and all of that stuff, but I swear, I was sitting with, at the time I had a roommate, I was sitting with my roommate, she was watching American Idol, which, you know, no offense to American Idol, but I'd rather take a beating than sit through that show, so I had my laptop open and I was you know, doodling around with email and Facebook and everything, and there was nothing else really to do, and I just opened up a Word file, and the first chapter just filled out. And I ended up handing my laptop to my roommate and saying, can you read this? And she read it, and she said, do you know what happens next? And I said, yeah, I think I do. And she's like, then keep on going. Yeah, keep on writing. So that's how Awake in Hell was born, just out of boredom. But what I think, after it was done and after it was over, I thought, okay, you know, where am I right now, and why would I have written this story? And I think at the end of the day, the story is a giant metaphor for how we feel when we reach midlife, when we reach middle age, whatever we perceive middle age to be. And I think a lot of what we perceive middle age to be is when we see our children or younger people in our lives setting out on their own path, and they find themselves all excited as you see them running into, you know, a burning building or whatever, but they're just all excited, you know, and you see them making the same mistakes and doing the same things that you did, and you start thinking, if I had it to do all over again, what wouldn't I do? What would I do? What, you know, coulda, woulda, shoulda. And then you're also dealing with older people, your parents or other people that are influential in your life who are now aging and, you know, getting ready to transition. So I think everybody's middle age is that time when they are reliving their youth and dealing with all the regret and guilt that comes with that, and also, you know, finding themselves thinking about death a lot more than they used to. That can, you know, that can create that kind of identity crisis that we associate with middle age. And so I think that's where that story came from.
Okay, that's great. Good. And I, you know, and it's interesting that that's what would be, you know, your take of what you were going through at that time. Can you tell me, what was the hardest part of writing this book?
Well, you know, it's always hard when you're having to write kind of in your spare time, you know?
Right.
When you have a full-time job and you are a full-time mother, and what was also happening during this time, like I said, at the time I had a roommate, I now am back home with my mom and dad because my mom was diagnosed with terminal cancer. So, you know, my dad called and said, we need you to come home. So I knew that that was happening too. So I have that too. So with all of that going on in my life, the hardest thing about writing is finding the time to write. But I try to write something every single day, even if it's just a few paragraphs or, you know, just a couple of pages. I try to write something every single day.
You know, I like the fact that you say you try to write something every single day. I try to ask authors that I, you know, interview some things about their, you know, about their work habits and the habits that they developed. And I'd like to ask you, you know, do you have a favorite place that you like to write? Because a lot of people, when I'm doing my research, I research even where they live, because a lot of times I know that when I lived in Arlington, I just thought that was the most inspirational place to be a writer at the time. They had so much, for a history person, I love history, it was a great place to be. Do you have a favorite place that you like to write?
You know, it's interesting because a lot of people, and you know, I too have met and especially since the publication of Awake in Hell, I've spent a lot of time with a lot of authors, and a lot of them say, I like this place because it's quiet, or this place because it's serene, or this place because I'm alone with my thoughts. I need activity around me. I need background noise, and so I find that I do my best writing if I am in a public place or in a place where there's other people. I do a lot of writing. I have I have two very, very good friends. I talk about them in the acknowledgement of the book. One was the roommate where I started the book, and the other was my best friend where I finished the book. I actually took 3 days off of work. Once I knew that I was almost done, I took 3 days off of work, and I turned off my phone and everything else, and I went to her house, because her house has all this activity, people coming and going. They work different shifts. Her and her husband, he works nights, she works days. They're, her two sons are constantly coming and going. And so the house always has activity 24/7. And that's where I sat and finished the book. And I do a lot of writing in cafes and bookstores and libraries and stuff like that where there are people around me. And every once in a while, I'll even, you know, if there are people at the office who are going to stay late and work late, then I'll stay late and do some writing while there are people around me.
Oh, that's great. So that goes into my next question. How do you develop your characters for your book? Because you like the activity and you like being around people. Did some of your characters take on some of the things that you see with the people around you? How do you develop your characters?
Right. Yes, and you know, Louise, who is my main character, Louise is a conglomerate, I think, of everybody I've ever met. You know, she's got a little bit of this person and a little bit of that person, and she's also a little bit of me. People I know read the book and they say, you know, Louise is just like you, or Louise, when Louise speaks, I hear you saying these things. She's just so you. But in reality, she's not. In reality, she's a little bit of so many people who I enjoy being around, you know? And so, yeah, you know, all of my characters, there's not a character in my book that I can say is this person, or, you know, is mostly that person. But every character in my book is someone. And everyone who is close to me and who knows me well can find something in that book and say, oh, that's totally me. Yeah?
Right.
You wrote this without me. Right.
Right. I remember it was a thing going around in the writers' committee. I'm part of different writers' groups, and someone said, they were talking about people that are around them, and they said, don't make me mad or I'll just do you in my book.
I've got a mug that says, please don't annoy the writer. She'll put, yeah. In her next book, she will kill you.
I thought that was just yeah. Such the most hilarious thing I ever heard of. I said, well, that's a good way to keep the stress off.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to go to a short little break. And when we come back, Helen, I want you to read a little excerpt from your book.
Okay.
So everyone, take a nice little short break. We're going to come back, and we're going to hear Helen read us a short little excerpt, and then we're going to continue on with our interview today with author Helen Downing. So we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Thank you. Magazine is back with built-in radio format serving a global audience. For only $25, your ad will be aired on Vertical Bistro and Vertical Cafe at prime time and continues to reach our audience through our taped broadcast. Contact ads at verticalmagazine.net.
And we're back with A Taste of Ink Live. Our featured guest is Helen Downing. I just wanted to take the time to say that that song was called What Is Given, another one of our songs from Marcus Boyd. Our great commercial voice is Miss Paulette Bowl, who is sponsoring our program today. Her Facebook page is called Paulette's Refurbished Laptops. If you want to look for a nice laptop for your son or daughter, or you need one and a fix, contact Paulette. She is a Microsoft Office engineer with much experience and does a great job. So now we're back with Helen Downing. And Helen, I wanted you to read a little portion of a little excerpt from your book for our audience, so I'm going to let you go from here.
Okay.
This is when Louise is talking about the fact that she's just been fired, and she talks about where she works. I was in tech support at the IP&FW, Internet Porn and Fetish Web. See, we have high-speed internet down here, but every search leads back to IP&FW. If you search for your grandmother's recipe for chocolate zucchini cake, you arrive at a site where naked girls sit and squirm on your granny's favorite dessert. If you attempt to look up your favorite football team, you land on overweight gay romance. Oh, and if this would have ever turned you on when you were alive, it will not down here. For instance, if you search hot lesbian sex, you'll be taken to images and videos of disfigured lesbians literally on fire attempting to have sex. What can I say? This is hell. I spent every day at a call center listening to newcomers bitch about not being able to follow their favorite sports teams or download a single Miley Cyrus MP3 from their computers. Then one day, I got a call from a gentleman who claimed he couldn't get online at all. I asked him if he'd reset his modem, and he didn't seem to know what I was talking about. I then asked him if he'd had internet when he was breathing, and he claimed that no, he was unable to get internet access when he was among the living due to the fact that he lived in the woods and eschewed technology while he was alive. I pondered why he might want internet now when he had gone so long without it. I imagined maybe he had more to entertain himself when he was alive, like HBO or masturbation. He claimed to have spent his entire welfare check every month on baked beans and guns. Oh, and the occasional purchase of lye and burlap bags for body disposal. Anyway, to make a long story short, I told him he would occasionally have to reset his modem by unplugging it, waiting 30 seconds, and plugging it back in. Simple, right? Everybody knows that, right? Well, he didn't, and I told him exactly what to do step by step, which constitutes being helpful. Being helpful in tech support at IP&FW is in direct opposition to their primary directive, which is an immediate terminable offense. Ugh, how was I supposed to know that I was talking to the only person in the entire hellverse that would find the resetting the modem spiel actually helpful? So now I have to find another job.
Okay. I mean, Helen, did you, seriously, when you were writing this, didn't you have to laugh at some of this when you were writing it?
Yeah.
Just quit and just
start
laughing?
You know, that is the one thing that always, always annoys the crap out of me when you call tech support, is the very first thing they do is give you the whole resetting the modem spiel, and it's like, I know that, okay? I've already tried that, you know? Stop it with the unplug the modem and re-plug it in. I've already done that. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was my little, you know, screw you to everybody in tech support that makes you reset the modem first thing out.
Yeah, I definitely could relate to that because it's just such an annoying thing that when you make those calls and they tell you how to, and it's kind of like, does it ever dawn on them that they've said this so many times and you could be calling for the 50th time.
Right. Yeah. And then they start in. Well, first thing you need to do is reset your modem. No, I've done that.
Yeah. It's like that. That's why I'm calling you. It didn't work.
Right. And so, yeah, so I was thinking, okay, how would you actually get fired in hell? Well, you would get fired in hell if you were actually helpful, because, you know, that's probably not cool in hell. And, you know, the very first thing she's going to say is the whole resetting the modem thing, so who wouldn't have heard of that?
Right. Well,
so the Unabomber wouldn't have heard of that. Yeah.
That was really one of my favorite parts, because I laughed so hard on that part. I was like, oh my gosh, like, how did you even get there? But I was going to say, what was your favorite part of your book?
You know, I don't want to give away too much, you know, because of the, but I think the whole relationship between Louise and Dee Dee, especially when she discovers Dee Dee actually is, but even before that, the whole relationship between her and Dee Dee was very, very important to me. I fell in love with Dee Dee in like the first 5 minutes that he presented himself in the book, and I felt that closeness with that character, and I really wanted, you know, I really wanted the reader to sense her closeness and her feeling of just wanting to please him, but he's not necessarily the kind of person to hold approval over your head.
Right.
You know, that their love was unconditional, and
right.
But it, yeah, that very complicated relationship that, and again, I don't want to give too much away, but it's each and every one of us has our own version of Dee Dee, and we all have a very complicated relationship with that particular person, and I really wanted them to feel that. I really wanted the reader to feel that, and that's my favorite part of the book is exploring that relationship.
Okay. I'm going to ask you now a couple of questions about when you published your book, about publishing and about a few little things that some of us authors might want to know or readers might want to know. Like for your book, do you feel you write in a certain genre, or do you just kind of go with the flow and whatever you feel like writing, that's where it's going to fit?
Right. Well, when I look at the projects that I've done in the past, this is the first book that I've actually seen published on a international level.
Okay.
But before that, I had written several other novels and short stories that, you know, were very limited in their release. And genre, no, there is no particular genre. I do tend to stay within a certain theme, which is the idea of redemption and the idea of learning to forgive. It's, you know, to forgive others, but most especially to forgive yourself. And so, you know, that's my basic theme. I don't know if that, you know, maybe I've led a guilt-ridden life. I don't think so. I don't think so, but, you know, maybe I have, and maybe I'm, you know, I think you write a lot of what you know, and so maybe I'm trying to figure out how to forgive myself, but I believe in forgiveness, and I believe in redemption, and I believe that it's never too late to start over, and so that's what I tend to write about.
I love it that you said it's never too late to start over. That's one of my mantras, that it's never too late to start over, because I've seen when I, one of my friends sent me, they must have sent me a book, thinking about it now, it was a bunch of papers, but it was copies she had made of authors who had written, you know, famous books, famous authors, but the theme that was throughout what I read with different authors was that they all started after their 40s, and so that was very, I thought, very inspiring, because, you know, I think some people get into this writing and they think that, oh, I'm going to become published and famous, you know, before I get 40. And a lot of times, I think one of the most interesting little tidbits that I learned was that James Michener, he actually worked for a publishing company when he wrote his first novel, and it was interesting that when he presented it to the publisher to be published, they said, oh, heck no, we're not publishing this, no. And he kind of took it on faith. He was in his late 40s. He quit, went across the street, gave the book to the publisher over there, and they published it, and his career started.
Yeah. I think, I think writing is the one artistic thing that you can, well, you could also learn to paint in your 40s and 50s, but, you know, you can't become a ballet dancer at the age of 45. You can't become a rock star at the age of 45, you know, but you can, but you can't, and there are a lot of writers out there who are younger than their 40s, but I think that you can't really find your inner voice or your true message or really, really write something fabulous unless you're, unless you have some life experience, you know?
Right. I would agree with you there. Do you think that another part of writing or being a writer is to be out there and experience, you know, I'm going to say experience life, whether it's reading work, whether it's watching TV, seeing movies, and, you know, like what you said, you know, you like being out there in the public, or you like things to be happening around you. Do you think this is an important part of feeding your, you know, feeding your mind and
I
giving your mind?
I think that's absolutely important. I think Stephen King said you can't be a good writer unless you're an avid reader, and I think that is absolutely true. Anybody who tries to write, and the most that they've read in the past 10 years is a newspaper article or the headlines on the trash magazines in the grocery store line, that's not going to work. You know, you have to be able to immerse yourself in a book and get lost in that before you can tap into making sure that your reader will have the same experience with what you write.
Right.
Any occupational hazards?
Yeah, do you think there's any occupational hazards to being a writer?
You know, I don't know. I don't know, because I love books, and I love to read books, and... You know, I don't love every book that's out there, obviously, you know, I've read some books and you know, been a little miffed when they're done because I feel like I want that 3 hours back. You know, I would say. The big thing is I also love film and love TV and stuff like that, but, you know, the big thing is if you've read the book, you know, usually the movie is going to suck.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've always read the book, you know?
Right. Do you think there's... it's really interesting that you said that, because I tend to love old movies because they tend to follow the book, and it just seems to be, and it could be because I sometimes feel that Hollywood, in order to make money, will embellish a writer's book more than what the writer probably wanted in the first place. I know of some series that they have where actually the last sequel is not really part of the book. It's something they decided to put together or take part of the book and make it into another sequel. And so I think that it has taken out the flavor or the power of the power that it packs when you read the book, until they actually do the movies. Very few movies I saw that really followed the book, and when they did, it was like, oh my goodness, this is, how wonderful is this?
right. Well, and that's true. That's very true. I can list on one hand the number of movies that I was like, oh, that was excellent, and I read the book first. But I think the difference is, but then when I look at television, you know, you look at series like Dexter and Game of Thrones, those are amazing, amazing TV shows. And if you read the books, they're also amazing books. But the TV show tends to, the first couple of episodes tends to follow the book, and then it just goes in its own direction and does its own thing.
Right.
And you know, and that's amazing. You know, that's just very, very cool for any writer to see what happens to their characters if you allow them to live on. You know, so I love TV shows that are based on books. But
yeah, I do too. I think it's really amazing when I see some of these series, because my whole thought process is like, okay, these writers for this show have really great insight to be able to take that book and put it into a series, and to keep you interested in that series
right.
as it goes. I'm a very, I love to read, but I'm a very visual person too. So, you know, I really can see, you know, when the writer is writing, I'm very visual while I'm reading at the same time. And so to be able to see that on television, like you said, and see these series, I'm like, wow. These writers that write that have to have some really great insight to be able to write this and keep my attention on the series.
Right. Well, look at Bones. That's a great example of, you know, Kathy Reich's books. You know, Kathy Reich has written this whole series of books about Temperance Brennan and
right.
And then she was part of the, you know, creation of the show.
Right.
And still, I think, a producer of the show. But the show just took it in a completely different direction. So now, if you were a fan of the show and then you picked up a Kathy Reich's book, you would be like, this is a completely different Temperance Brennan, you know?
Exactly.
But I love the fact that Temperance Brennan on the show is a writer who writes about a character named Kathy Reich. And, yeah, so they've got that whole thing happening. But it's, you know, I think it's very, very cool. I think it would be very cool as a writer. I think it would be cool to watch what would happen if your character were basically allowed to live on, and through other writers and through other eyes, you get
right,
to see
true.
Your characters live their life. Yeah, I think
I remember when I took creative writing class, our instructor had us do like a storyboard, and he said, what actors would you like to play your characters? And I remember when I put mine together, and he looked at it and he said, you must intend on having a lot of money.
Yeah.
The actors I had picked were like high dollar actors.
Right. Well, of and course, I, we all imagine, that, right, we all imagine that.
Oh, yeah, and I said to him, well, you know, hey, I'm going for the gold, and I'm really thinking that this is going to happen, so.
Right. Well, and what's interesting, I'm a huge, anybody who is a friend of mine on Facebook, and please, all listeners, friend me on Facebook if you want. But anybody who is a friend of mine on Facebook knows that I am a huge Doctor Who fan.
Uh-huh.
So when I started describing Dee Dee in the book, I made him physically very, very much like the 10th Doctor.
Uh-huh.
So that's who I see. So I see the actor David Tennant playing Dee Dee in my mind, you know?
Right.
So in my mind, it's David Tennant.
Nothing wrong with that, though. But I would think that being able to have that vision and being able to see them, you know, and what they do in acting really can give you, you know, more insight of how you want your character to act and talk. And, you know, so I think that does that for you. So let me ask you this. Who would be your favorite author?
Well, and that's hard, you know, because that's like saying kids is your favorite, because I just have so many authors that I love and adore.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher Moore is a big one.
Okay.
And I have to tell you, when Awaken Hell first came out, a woman showed up at a book signing, and she said, you know, when I first opened it and started reading the first couple of chapters, I felt like I was reading a new Christopher Moore. And I was like, oh, you know, that's like telling me, you know, that's like telling me, you know, that's like the best compliment anybody could ever give me.
Right, exactly.
Because Christopher Moore is amazing. He is absolutely amazing. I also love Tom Robbins, Neil Gaiman. Stephen King is such a prolific writer that I like some of Stephen King, not all. I love Stephen Fry. Yeah, there's just so many writers that I love. I also, you know, if I'm going to the beach, then I want the new Sophie Kinsella or somebody like that, you know, just junk food for the mind, but it's well written.
Right. Okay, like what I want to do is I want to take another break, because I do want you to read one more excerpt from your book. This has been a great interview, and I know that our audience is really enjoying this. And when we come back after we read some excerpts, I would really love to get your thoughts on the occupation of writing for other writers, and then, you know, we'll go from there. So let's take a break, everyone. Please just stay tuned. We're enjoying this conversation with Helen Downing, the author of Awaken Hell. We'll be back shortly. Thank you. Thank you. And we're back. This is the Taste of Ink, and our guest today is author Helen Downing. And we are coming back to listen to Helen read another excerpt from her book. I'd like to say that this program is sponsored today by Paulette Bowles, who is the owner of Paulette's Refurbished Laptops. You can find her on Facebook. Okay, Helen, I'm just enjoying this interview with us, and I would love for our audience to hear another excerpt from your book. So take it away, Helen.
All right. When I first got here, I thought I was still alive. See, I don't remember the actual act of dying. I remember the whole cancer thing, and I remember my mom and dad at the kitchen table with power of attorney papers and other legal shit that they kept shoving in front of me, and I kept signing. They could have handed me a $1 million check, and I'd have signed it and pushed it back across the table at that point. I was still numb. I remember the doctor saying that my cancer had metastasized despite the mastectomy, and now I had invaded several lymph nodes and a few other required organs. He said I had 6 months to a year, and I remember the day that marked the six-month anniversary of that meeting. I don't remember what we did, but I do remember going to bed that night thinking, from this point on, I'm on borrowed time. I remember lying in the hospital, surrounded by people. I can't really remember who was there, and I find it fascinating that my mind has the impression there were a lot of people around me. I mean, how many people are you planning to have at your deathbed? Even today, I'm thinking three people tops, and I was young and quite popular, if I do say so myself. Yet my cloudy brain won't show me faces, but gives me impressions that there were more. I see my mom standing over me, and she's talking, but I can't hear what she says. Then fade to black, as the movie people say. Then, sorry if this point, this part ruined some great fantasy, but there was no tunnel or doorway or bright light. There was no floating above my body or watching my own funeral. There were no giant pearly gates, for obvious reasons. There was no trial, no judgment, no sentence. Just dark and quiet for a while. Then I woke up here. Not in my apartment. I woke up under an overpass outside of town. I had to walk for what seemed like forever, and the whole time I was thinking, who in the fuck lets a dying girl fall asleep outside of a road? What's weird is that I can remember every single detail of some random Saturday when I was 20 years old. And I can remember every single gift I received for my 30th birthday. I know that I was 43 years old when I died, but I can't remember turning 43. It seems the closer I got to my doom, the more my brain started to purge important details. Either that or I had successfully killed enough brain cells at that point to be legally retarded. Once I reached town, I knew I wasn't in Kansas or any other state anymore. There were huge skyscrapers, and it was all glass, and the heat was intolerable. And everyone around me looked like they were leaving or on their way to the worst costume party ever thrown. I walked until I was about to buckle from heat stroke, or so I thought, again, still thinking I was alive. That's when I came upon the gargantuan IP&FW building. I looked across the street, and the opposing glass facade reflected the entire IP&FW building, so much that it obscured the reflective building's identity. I entered the officious building and was offered employment, after being told I was dead. Oh, and then they let me know that I was naked and issued me a mohair spa robe infested with body lice. Funnily enough, they never actually had to tell me where I was. Even the dullest knife in my mother's entire baby-proof kitchen would have figured that out. And that refers to the outfits, which is, you know, all about the closet, which is an interesting component of the book, which just, I have no idea where it came from, but I get a lot of emails saying, where did you come up with the closet? But the closet is magical, and it, her closet every day reveals one outfit, and that's what she has to wear, and it's always ridiculous, and it's always punitive.
Yeah, there's so much in the book that is just really thought-provoking, but at the same time, there's a lot of, you know, things I found just hilarious, and I don't want to give it away because I think this is a very good read. I just love the way you've put it together and just taken so many things about life And really, and when you think about it, it really is funny. And I know with growing up, my kids think I'm the craziest mother on earth, probably, because I used to always play little gags on them, and, you know, nothing to hurt, but it would just be, you know, sometimes I would just laugh because I knew my kids so well, and I knew what their response would be. So I would start laughing before the thing would even, you know, before they even found it or whatever, and I start laughing, and they used to say, "Mom, you're not funny," and I would laugh even harder. I'm like, "Yes, I am." And so, you know, and we still do that. It's so hilarious. But, you know, the book had so many things in there that just reminded me of different things in life that really, when you really think about it before you let yourself get upset, it really is hilarious. So I wanted to ask you if you had a current project that you could share with us.
Yes, I'm actually working on two different projects. One is much heavier. It's called Getting Better, and it's all about another girl who is dying. She has a very rare disease, and she's been sickly her entire life. She's now at the end, and she's in the hospital. Because she was sickly her entire life, she was unable to go outside and play or go to regular school or do really anything with her life. She stayed at home, and she lived her life vicariously through television. And in particular, there was one soap opera that she absolutely loved, and and her sister is in the hospital gift shop, and she sees a star of the soap opera and convinces the star to come up and meet her sister, and that's how it begins, and I won't give anything else away, but that is one project that I'm working on. And then the other is a more funny, lighthearted one, and that's called Yesterday's Girls. And it's about three women, two of which were married to the same man, the other of which had an affair with that man. And now they're all three, you know, they've all three been, you know, shoved off for yet another new one. And they end up becoming very good friends and helping each other get past that whole, you know, the whole idea of marrying the wrong man and you know, giving up your youth and everything for the wrong relationship, and then you find yourself middle-aged and dating again and going, how did this happen? And that's going to be called Yesterday's Girl.
Okay. Well, we're definitely going to be looking forward to that. Before we go into some more questions here, Helen, please tell our readers where they can find your book, Awaken Hell, how they can find you. Do you have a fan page?
Yes. You can find me at, you can find the book on Amazon, wherever you are, whatever country you're in, you can find me in your version of Amazon. Search for Awake in Hell, and it will come up. It's available as a paperback and as a Kindle version. It says on the about the author, it says, "Please go buy my book. It's my last chance of fulfilling my complete potential and possibly getting into heaven." So I appreciate anybody who buys my book. You can find Awaken Hell. Awaken Hell has a fan page on Facebook. So you can find that. You can also find me on Facebook under Helen Downing. But Awaken Hell also has its own Facebook page. So.
And I want to say, I really like the epitaph, but I'm not going to give that away.
Right.
And definitely, you'll also be able to hear this rebroadcast on A Taste of Link Inc. Live. I'm sorry, A Taste of Ink Live page on Facebook. You'll also be able to hear this on Vertical Magazine in our section called A Taste of Ink Live, and there'll also be a link to Helen's Facebook page and to being able to purchase her book on Amazon. So now we've given you all the information. You have no excuse not to go get this book, Awaken Hell.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. I want to ask you a couple of questions now. One thing is the state of publishing books has changed so much in just the last few years. I mean, I think it changes exponentially almost every 6 months now. So when it came to publishing and marketing your book, do you think social media was an important part of marketing your book?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The whole social media, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, but also AuthorsDB, Goodreads, all of that has been phenomenal. Also, there are just so many bloggers and broadcasters and other people like you who are, you know, people who love books and, you know, want to help promote books, you know, that are now, they now have a voice, they now have a venue for their writing, and they're happy to share it with other writers. So, yeah, the whole social media thing has been fabulous. It's been great for promotion. It has been outstanding for networking and for just meeting other people, you know. People, you know, when computers first came out and computers first started becoming prevalent, you know, people used to say all the time, computers are going to be the death of us because they're going to isolate us. You know, people who, you know, people will not go meet other people now. Now they're going to be stuck on their computer all the time. They're going to be sitting all by themselves with their nose in a computer. I find just the opposite to be true. And I think if you are naturally a social person, I think that using a computer makes the world very, very small. You know, I made one of my main characters from Wales, and I had a very good friend of mine who I had never met. I have now met him face to face, but at the time I had never met him face to face. He lives in Wales. He lives in Cardiff, Wales. So I said, I'm making my main character from Cardiff, Wales. And he's like, okay, great. And he sent me just boxes and boxes and boxes of information and copies of Welsh expressions and other things. So that I could just immerse myself in that, so that I could make my main character Welsh.
Great. Well, also, I really like that. I mean, because I've seen it go from, I remember when I came out of school, it was like, okay, just send your book out to like 50 publishers and go from there.
Right.
But I've seen so many people have such success. In fact, it was interesting because maybe a few years later, a friend of mine who was very heavily into doing websites, designing websites, and said, no, Celeste, this is really the way of things to come. And, you know, you need to get a website. You need to get out there. And I was like, And over that time, I've seen many writers. I've met some great writers through social media. One of the reasons for this program is because not only did I meet them on social media, I met them on my travels, and I thought, you know, I mean, sometimes some authors I've met that are not really well-known in other countries, I'm like, but they write very beautifully, and I said, you know, it would be nice to just have something to introduce authors to people. That's how I've learned to find authors. I didn't have any special authors when I would read, but someone would say to me, oh, I just read this great book by so-and-so, and I'd go and get it, and then I became a fan of that writer, and then I would read all their books. Right. So definitely I just felt like, you know, this is a great way to meet other writers. I also thought it was a great way for writers to communicate different challenges in writing to each other, and other writers would not feel like they were so alone. And I've gotten some great, great advice from the writers that have been on this program. Each one has their own different take, but I always say, no matter what, there's someone out there that needs to listen to your take, you know, that will understand your take on it. So I always ask these questions. So, like, for you, what are the attributes in remaining a sane writer? and I really, I have to say that because I've heard.
I don't think there's any future. I really don't think there's any future in being a sane writer. I embrace the insanity. Because, you know, the greatest writers in history have been mad. So, no, absolutely maybe, no future whatsoever in being a sane writer.
Right. Well, maybe sanity for us is being insane.
Absolutely.
That, no, you're not. It's like saying, no, you're not crazy. That really happens in the writing world.
Right. Well, it's funny. I wrote the other night on Facebook. I just did a little, I thought it was like a little throwaway status, you know, just to say something before I went to bed. So I said, my mind is wandering to strange destinations. And the next morning I woke up and I had like all these comments, but I went to work and my boss, she said, Helen, I saw your Facebook status last night. And I just have to tell you, the passport of your mind is stamped with places I have never even heard of. and I was like, and you know what? I am going to take that as a compliment. I don't even care how you intended it.
as a writer, I want to ask you, where do you put writing as far as occupation? Is writing your first occupation now that you've published your first book and that you are actually writing? Whether or not you have a second job, do you consider writing your number one priority as your job, your career?
No, but that is just because, I mean, this is not to say that I don't love my job, because I do. I absolutely love, love, love my job as an account executive. I really, really love what I do, and I love, you know, who I get to meet. And I basically, you know, basically what I do for a living is go out and make friends with people and build relationships with people and then help them make their business more successful. But I do it for money, and if they didn't pay me, I wouldn't do it, you know? But
right.
If they didn't pay me to write, I would still do it. So I would love to be able to say that someday I won't have to have a day job and I'll be able to make my living off writing, but in a way I'm really not looking forward to that, because I don't want to ever get up and say, ugh, today I have to go to work and mean writing. I don't ever want to have to do that.
Right.
That's my take on it. I do very much like telling people that I'm a writer.
Right.
And I love it when people around town, because I'm an account executive, I know everybody. And I've known everybody for years because this has been my primary career for most of my adult life. And I love it that now, I'll be sitting there talking to people I've known for 20 years, and they'll say, "Have you met Helen? She's our local celebrity." Or, "Have you met Helen? She's our local author," or whatever. And I love that. I suck all that up like a sponge. I consider myself but I also really like being an executive. I really like being part of the professional world too. I used to own my own business. I used to own a little retail store on Main Street in Dover. So I have always had a soft spot for locally owned businesses, and I understand their challenges, and I understand what they can and can't do, and I understand what keeps them awake at night. So I love the fact that I get to do that for a living too.
That's awesome. And authors are interesting people.
Absolutely.
I think they're the most interesting people, because you get such a different, and they have their own diversity, and it's just rather interesting to talk to different writers. So I always think, when people say, "Oh, they're a writer, wow."
Right.
How interesting. What advice would you give to other writers, Helen, that feel that they run out of creativity when they're writing? What advice would you give them, and what do you think is important for a writer to understand? And I want your take, because, like I said, you never know who's thinking the same way you are,
right,
to take what you say and make it fit for their lives.
Well, a lot of times I use writing as therapy,
Mm-hmm.
So if I need a catharsis, or I need to get when I need a little perspective or something, I might write a scene that is more touching or more self-reflective or sad or whatever. If I am just feeling silly or, devil may care, I might sit and write a totally funny or silly scene. I don't really worry about writing in order. I usually start with an outline, so I know what direction the characters are going to go in. I know where the character needs to be, but I don't necessarily plot out the path as to how they're going to get there. I will write scenes based on what I need to fulfill for me that day. And then I'll worry about putting it in the right order. And then I'll worry about what I think is the most tedium part of writing, which is the whole, all right, getting her from this scene to this scene, where you have to do all the descriptions and all the background and all the, the background music, the jazz of the book. that is,
right,
you know, that is tedium to me. But I know other authors. I know other authors that say, I love that. You know, I love that, you know, describing a room and letting people know every nuance and every aspect of that room and creating that ambiance or that feeling that the character has when they enter this place. And whereas I just go, oh, now I have to describe a chair. How am I going to do that?
Right.
But, you know, so it's, so that, you know, that is how I approach it. I know other people who can't imagine writing non-chronologically. But I can totally do that. I can write two scenes that are, you know, one will be in chapter 3 and one will be in chapter 14, and I'll write those back to back.
Okay. Great. Well, Helen, I have so enjoyed this program today, and I know that our audience has enjoyed it as well. Definitely, everyone, you can find Helen also on A Taste of Ink Live, the section in Vertical Magazine at Vertical with a K, magazine.net. Helen, do you have any last thoughts that you'd like to give to our audience before we go? I feel so privileged that I'm doing a show where I get to read these books, because this has been a great book for me. It's been very therapeutic this week.
Well, thank you.
It has been very therapeutic to really laugh and see things in a totally different way in my world for a week.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. And yes, if I were to have one last thought, it would be one of gratitude. I mean, it's weird when you, especially I think your first book, but when you put something out there that is, you know, like a piece of your soul, and you just stick it out in the world, it's kind of like, you know, finding out there are naked pictures of you on the internet. But instead of your body, it's your soul that they can look at and critique and be critical of and everything else. But, you know, I have gotten many, many just tremendous emails and visitors at places where I've made appearances and Amazon reviews and Goodreads reviews and all of that. And, you know, I am just so grateful for every single person who has picked up my book and has taken the time to read it. And, you know, and the best I can hope for is that, you know, it touched you in some way, even if it did just make you laugh on a hard day, or if it, you know, if it brought you some comfort or some joy, that is tremendous to me. It really, really is. So I'm very, very grateful to everyone who is
listening. Well, Helen, thank you
and
for
who will read.
Yeah, thank you so much for being saying yes to being a guest on the show. Definitely, I want you all to go out and pick up Helen's book, Awake in Hell. And definitely, you know, listen to this broadcast. It's a great broadcast. It will be a repeat broadcast. You can find it on the page, A Taste of Ink Live on Facebook, or listen to it on Vertical Magazine, or either listen to it on Blog Talk Radio. Helen, thank you so much. And definitely, let's keep our connection. You know, I definitely want to hear what you're doing. And when you're ready to come back, my doors are always open.
Thank you. Thank you, Celeste. Absolutely. Thank you very, very much.
And thank our audience for your support. Thank you for Paulette Bowl for being the sponsor for this Six of Ink Live, and we'll be looking to see everyone again.
This is the last take for the night. Understand it's kind of late, and I gotta get home to my son, 'cause he's so special to me. I mean, I gotta see him, I need to breathe him. That's my baby, don't call me crazy. I love the studio, but I love them all. Let me give you what I got, so I woke up in the morning feeling fresh to death. I'm so blessed, yes, yes. I went to sleep stressed, woke up refreshed. I'm so blessed, yes, yes. Water in my face and everything is in its place. Peace of mind, even my grave. I'm so blessed, yes, yes, yes. My grandma almost lived to see 92. I'm so blessed, yes, 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 yes. My son was born healthy and beautiful. I'm so blessed, yes, yes. My mama's on my right side, daddy on my left, yes. My son, father doing is absolute. I'm so blessed, 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 blessed. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I know what I know. And I know what I know. Trouble gon' happen, it's just the way it be. Ain't nothing coming easily in this life. Sometimes you gotta work and you gotta grow and it gotta hurt. I'm sure you know, take a look around. Woke up this morning listening to this song. You're so blessed, yes, yes. Gonna rock the joint all day long. You're so blessed, yes. Went to sleep stressed, woke up refreshed.